Happy New 2009. Day 2.
My name is not Jez Fletcher, and I am not a software engineer, although I do work for Google Australia. Jez, unfortunately, has come down with a bout of glandular fever, so I'm stepping in for Jez today. My name's Tor Mitchell. Some of you may remember me from giving a similar talk last year. I'm a senior technical solutions engineer for Google Maps API Premier, which essentially is the enterprise version of the Google Maps API. I work in with the Maps API developer platform team here in Sydney. Some of you know Google Maps as we know it has its origins here in Sydney. And consequently, there's still a lot of Maps development that goes on here, including the Maps API. So I'm still going to use Jez's slides. I'm aware that you have a copy of those. I've made some additional notes of my own to augment that, and we'll try and blend them together in a quasi-seamless manner. Basic overview of what we're going to cover. The goal today is just to go over what the API can do and an introduction as to how you get started with it and the sort of things you might want to do with it. We're going to obviously cover loading the API, adding controls, overlays. Overlays essentially are any type of your data that you want to display on the map. And essentially, that's the core of what the Maps API is about. It's our maps. It's your data. And then a few services that add additional value to the Maps API. Okay, so I just want to talk briefly about what the Maps API actually is. Some of you may have, I'm sure some of you have witnessed the Maps API in action. You may not have consciously realized it. I'm sure others of you are very familiar with it. We have a lot of popular websites use the Maps API here in Australia. Here's one I'm sure most of you are familiar with if you've ever looked for a property locally. So let's see. Martin seems only appropriate. And I can click on view on map here. Okay. Here we have a fairly standard Maps API site. So essentially these are the familiar-looking Google Maps. You can see the map control that you probably recognize from the Google Maps website over here for zooming, overview map in the corner here. But it's real estate's own data in terms of the markers that they've placed on the map. And you can click on a particular marker and get information about that particular property. You can also see that they have built their own map type buttons up here to fit in with their house style. So the Maps API provides you with a great deal of flexibility in terms of how you present your map. You can customize all of the controls that you see. Pretty much the only thing that you cannot change is the actual map itself. So you can choose between the regular maps, satellite maps, hybrid maps, and we also have a terrain or physical map type, which gives you contours. Apart from those four different map types, everything else pretty much can be tailored to your needs. So Google Maps itself was launched around February 2005, and the Maps API followed not long after, in June 2005. And the Maps API was a response to several independent developers who reverse-engineered the way that Google Maps was working and applied it to their own websites. And this proved to be such a powerful concept that Google essentially decided to make that a publicly available service. Since then, the Maps API has come a long way. We've had a completely new version that overhauled a lot of the syntax and improved things a great deal. And now it's one of the most popular mashup APIs on the web. So this particular session is just concentrating on the JavaScript API. I should briefly mention that there are a couple of other Maps APIs that Google has. We have a Maps API for Flash, if you want to develop your Maps API application in ActionScript. There's also a static Maps API that just delivers map imagery, PNG, JPEG, format maps for lightweight clients, or for if you don't want the overhead of a full JavaScript implementation. So just a quick overview of some geospatial concepts before we dive in. It's good to know how these things are put together. The Maps API, or in fact Google Maps in general, it's all the same maps. We use what's known as a spherical Mercator projection, which essentially determines how we map the spherical Earth onto a flat surface, as we need to do. The simplest way to do that, if you and you see a lot of applications do this, is to simply map latitude longitude coordinates to XY coordinates. So latitude is your distance from the equator to the poles, and longitude is your distance away from the prime meridian that goes through Greenwich in the UK. So one approach is just to take your latitudes and longitudes and map them straight to XY. The problem with doing that is that you're essentially pulling apart the pole and stretching it out, and as you do so, the features towards the poles on the map become increasingly elongated outwards. And even at close zoom levels, this results in things that are square or circular on the ground being stretched into rectangles or ovals. And we don't want that. We want the map to look right even when you're zoomed in, because most people spend most of their time zoomed right in. So instead we use a Mercator projection. And what that essentially means is that as we stretch those as we stretch northerly latitudes and southerly latitudes apart, we stretch the latitude lines, the parallels, if you like, further apart at the same rate. And this keeps the scale, the if you like, the aspect ratio of particular points on the ground the same. It does have some unwanted side effects, though. Specifically, it causes regions towards the poles to appear much larger in area on the map than they actually are relative to regions around the equator. A good example of this is the relative sizes of Africa and Greenland. As you can see on this map, they look to be approximately the same, but in reality, Greenland is around 2 million kilometers square, and Africa is around 30 million kilometers square. So Africa is actually 15 times the land mass of Greenland. Okay. Another thing to bear in mind is that when we do this as a result of this projection, or as a result of most projections, a straight line on this map is not actually a straight line on the surface of the Earth in the logical sense, by which I mean, let me qualify that. A straight line on this map is a line of constant bearing, so if you walk in that direction, that's where you'll go. But it's not actually the shortest distance between two points. And the shortest distance between two points is known as a geodesic. Essentially, if you think of, for example, a line between the route between the UK and, say, Japan, the actual shortest route goes up over near the pole and back down. So, let me get rid of that. So, that having been said, how do we get started? Well, the Maps API is essentially imported as a JavaScript library, so you just use a script tag to bring it in. The script tag looks like this, maps.google.com/maps?file=API, and then a bunch of parameters we'll talk about in a moment. Alternatively, Google has a common loader, the Ajax API's common loader. Google now has a large number of Ajax APIs, and we are trying to bring them all together under a single umbrella loader so that you can load a single script at the top here, and then you can bring in additional APIs dynamically as you need them using this google.load function. So Maps is one, the Earth API is another, the Local Search API is another, the YouTube API, etc., etc. There are many different APIs that you can import in this manner. You'll see here it says JS API?key=your key. Key is one of the parameters also that you need in the tag further up. A key is essentially an identifier for you as a developer and your website. And if you want to use the Maps API, you have to first register for a key. And the key that you generate will be tied to a particular domain name. So if you register a key for company.com, you can use that on any site in that domain. Keys are fairly ugly looking 86-character long strings. of seemingly random numbers and letters. So, other parameters. I mentioned the key. The two mandatory other parameters are the version and the sensor parameter. So, version is the V parameter, and there are a number of different options for that. We release new versions of the Maps API, roughly speaking, on a weekly basis. Each version may not necessarily contain new features, it may just contain bug fixes, but we iterate on a weekly basis. Each version does have a version number. At the moment, we're on major version 2, as I mentioned, and then the minor version is the number that's incremented each week. We're currently at, I believe, 2.158, so we're at the 158th minor version of 2.x. Because we encourage people to use the latest versions to keep up with new developments, to adopt the bug fixes that we roll out, we provide a set of aliases which essentially point to a specific version, and those aliases are updated each week. The v equals 2.x points to the bleeding edge this week's new version. We put that out there to allow people to test and to report any problems they might report, but we strongly discourage you from using it on a production site, as it is fresh out of the oven. Instead, we recommend one of these other two versions. There is V equals 2, which essentially is a version we select as being the most recent version that has been reported to not be problematic and by people evaluating the 2.x versions. It can be as recent as the previous week's 2.x, or it can trail by a few weeks, but it rarely trails by more than 2 or 3 weeks. There's also V equals 2.s, which is labeled the stable release, although that's somewhat misnamed. 2.s is a hand-selected release that is normally really quite dated, but which has proven to be rock solid. You will sacrifice some of the more recent features if you choose to use 2.s, but if you're particularly sensitive to change, that may be the version for you. Another option down here, the sensor parameter. The sensor parameter is something we ask you to report to us. It has no consequence to your site or any licensing or such like, but it is something that we need to collect. Essentially, we ask that you set the sensor parameter, which is just sensor with a lowercase s, to true or false. You set it to true if your application is going to run on a device which is capable of identifying its own location, and your application will be using that location. So if you have a device such as a phone that has a GPS sensor or is capable of Wi-Fi triangulation, and your application will actually be using that, then we ask that you set sensor to true. If you have an application which runs on your desktop and collects and displays the location of devices that have sensors, you set sensor to false. The point is that the application has to be running on the device that has the sensor. Last option that Jez has put there, localization. This is optional, but recommended. Essentially, this HL parameter, you set it to a country code, and it will determine the language in which the various controls are displayed. It will also influence your geocoding results. Geocoding is the mapping of addresses to latitude-longitude pairs, so it will bias results towards that country. And it will also... that's wrong. That's the GL parameter. Which also takes the country code, and that will do your country code biasing. But yes, localization will just handle language issues. Okay, so what I'm going to do actually is we have a few code samples in here, but we also have the AJAX API's Playground, which I thoroughly recommend you have a look at. This is a great site we've put together for all our different APIs, where you can actually type code into this window in the top right and hit run and actually see it happen in the bottom left. So, for example, let's have a look at this map simple. Here we have a simple map initialization. I'm going to scroll down a little bit, just try and get more of it in. And you can see that we now have a map in the bottom left here. So, what are we doing here? Well, essentially, this is your snippet of JavaScript that you would have in your page. This would live in a script tag in the head of your document. And in the body of your document, at somewhere in that body, you would have a div, and that div would have an ID of map underscore canvas. And that is the div into which you wish the API to insert a map. That div can be sized as you as needed, and the map will be sized to fit. So if we just flip back to Jez's example briefly, you can see here, in the body, you set an onload handler that calls a function that creates the map. There's also an onUnload, which we recommend you set to this gUnload function, which is part of the Maps API, and that essentially unwinds various circular references and ensures that you don't have, suffer from memory leaks and such like when the page is garbage collected. So you can see here we have a div, map canvas, we've set a width and height 500 by 300, and then the function that creates the map simply checks that the application is running in a browser which the Maps API is compatible with, and then creates a new GMAP2 object. So the Maps API is a collection of these objects, sorry, collection of these classes, which are normally prefixed by a capital G. And there's one for markers, one for polygons, one for polylines, et cetera, and you create these objects and then you hook them up together. So this is essentially where you start. You say, I want a new map object. This is the div element I want to populate. This alone will not achieve anything because you won't see a map until you actually state where you want that map to be. In other words, you call map.setCenter. And you can see map.setCenter takes two parameters, a glat long object, which just represents a location on the Earth, and a zoom level, which is that 13 on the end there. Zoom levels start at zero, which is essentially go right out. That's actually zoom level one, and we don't go out to zoom level zero in Google Maps, but you can see as this loads that the maps are consist of these square, what we call map tiles, that are 256 by 256 pixels, and zoom level zero is the entire world on a single map, on a single map tile, and you can see that the whole world is represented as a square, and for those of you who are aware, the nature of the Mercator projection is that it goes to infinity. You cannot represent the poles because you're stretching latitudes as you stretch longitudes, and the pole is stretched out infinitely along the top. It goes to infinity. So the cutoff here is about plus or minus 85 degrees north and south. So zoom level zero is the whole world on a map. This is zoom level one, and then as you go in, the zoom factor doubles. Until we get into, I think, I need to check this now, the highest zoom level is around 20 or 21, but in most cases it goes up to about 18. That's not going to work. Bondi Beach. Bondi happens to be one of the places where we have some of the highest resolution imagery as a result of a Australia Day flyover we did a couple of years ago. So let's have a look. Keep going. Okay, so this is zoom level 22. So that's about as far in as you can go. Okay, so you can see here we have set the center to this location, which is near Palo Alto in California, and given a zoom level of 13. Okay. So that gets you your basic map, but clearly you want to do more than just that, and we've covered setting the center, and you can change the center at any time. You can also use panby and pan2, although that's not on this list. Panby says move the map by this distance, by this amount. Pan2 says move the map to this location, but if that location is already visible on screen, move as a smooth pan rather than a hard jump. You can also save positions, which essentially just keeps track of position and then bring it back at a later date, regardless of how much the user themselves have moved around. So let's see if we can... we'll come back to that. Another common thing you need to do is change the map types. You saw a moment ago when I was looking at Bondi Beach, I switched from a regular road map to a satellite map. The Maps API comes with a set of map types for you to use. You can define your own as well. And the default map types are represented in the Maps API as a set of constants, which you can see indicated by the fact that they're all in capitals. GNormal map is the name for the regular road map that you're most familiar with. GSatellite 3D map is unusual in that It actually invokes the Google Earth API. I'm not sure if you've seen the Google Earth API, but it's essentially an embedded copy of Google Earth running within your browser. Unlike the Maps API, it does require a plugin to be installed. But you can switch your map over to the Earth API if the plugin is installed, and your markers and polygons and polylines will be re-rendered within your Earth API view. I'm not actually sure if the Earth API is installed on this laptop, so I'm not sure if this will work. Okay. Yeah, I might give that a go towards the end. I don't want to waste too much time trying to get it to work just now. So, if we look at... okay, well, actually, why not use this for what it's intended? I'm going to just do this on the spot. I can do this, map, set map type, GM satellite. Oops. Give that a go. Success. Okay, so it's as simple as that. Now, clearly, you probably don't want to force a particular maps up on your users. You're probably going to want to have a control, and we'll come to how you do that in a moment. Here we go. So until recently, we provided with the Maps API a grab bag of different controls, and you could add the ones you wanted, put them where you wanted. However, we noticed that an increasingly large number of sites were just looking to replicate the user experience from maps.google.com, reuse people's familiarity with that user interface. So we've recently added this map.setui to default option, which essentially just sets up your user interface to mirror maps.google.com, and crucially means that if we make changes to the maps.google.com interface in the future, you will automatically inherit those changes once they've been migrated into the API as well. You can alter the default API, sort of take it and then make minor changes to it. But in most cases, people just stick with the default. So let's see what happens if we do that. Okay. So now we have a set of map buttons here, map type buttons, which switch from map to satellite hybrid. We have the newer revision of the zoom slider, the one with the nice blue 3D effects. We have down here, it's a bit hard to see, so I'm going to switch, what we call the scale control, which just indicates an approximate scale on the map. I wouldn't put, that works very well at higher zoom levels like this, but as you zoom out, it becomes increasingly inaccurate because your scale actually varies with latitude on a Mercator projection map. There's some things that are not obvious from here that set default UI also does. I'll give this a go with this laptop. It's not going to work. It enables scroll wheel zoom, essentially, so that if you've got a scroll wheel, you can roll the scroll wheel and the map will zoom in and out as well, and some keyboard handling for accessibility. So there are a few benefits to it. Okay, so however, you still have the option to add individual controls if you wish and customize the interface to your needs. If you didn't want to use the default UI to get that large map type control you saw on the left, you could just individually add it. And all the controls have their own classes, and those are all listed in the Maps API reference. Which is available on code.google.com and is essential reading if you're doing any Maps API development. So, I can, for example, do map.addControl, new, do small, see, now we'll do the last one, large. That. And now you see it's changed, the various buttons and things have gone away, and it's been replaced by the older style map zoom slider. Okay, and we also have the Google bar. The Google bar is essentially a way of embedding Google's local search API into your Maps API website. We have a very clear distinction between local search and address search. We'll talk about geocoding shortly, which is obtaining lat longs for specific addresses and vice versa. Local search is a separate service that Google offers that provides local business listing search. The Google Bar is essentially a simple control that embeds that functionality in your map for you and provides the various user interface changes you need to support it. So we can do, let's get this right now. Map.enableGoogleBar. So now we have this control in the bottom left-hand corner. There's actually a newer version of this control we recommend you use. There's an option that you can set that requests a new version. I just can't remember it off the top of my head. The only real difference is that instead of opening in this collapsed form, it opens in this expanded form. And we discovered that there was very poor discoverability on this. People didn't realize that this was actually something they could use, so we recommend you you adopt the new version. But essentially, it replaces the Google logo with this control that you can just click on, and it will bring up business listings and add them to your map. And it handles all that interactivity for you with just that one additional line of code. If you're also an AdSense partner, you can add your AdSense ID to this and generate advertising revenue from this control as well. Okay, I showed you the realestate.com example earlier, which had a map type control that clearly was specific to their website. It used their color screen. This is how you can build your own custom controls. We have a gcontrol interface you just need to implement, and the two key methods that must be implemented are initialize. That essentially has to return a div object that contains your control, and get default position, which returns a. We provide a set of constants that relate to the top left, bottom left, sorry, the four corners of the screen, and you essentially return one of those and then an offset from that corner. Again, we have an example of that. Okay, so you can see here, this is a very simple custom zoom in, zoom out control. If you take a look at the implementation up here, here's your initialize function, and we create a div element, we populate that with various things, and we return it at the end once we've set it up. And then in this get default position, here we return a new control position, so relative to the top left, inset 7 pixels by 7 pixels. And you can do just about anything you like in a custom control. The key point about controls is essentially that they are guaranteed to always appear on top of any markers or overlays. If you like, you can think of Maps API applications as having three layers. The map tiles are on the bottom, your overlays are in the middle, and your controls live on top. And on the subject of overlays, the overlays are really the heart of the Maps API. This is where you get to represent your data and render it on the map in a fashion that meets your needs. The simplest type of overlay is a marker, which just represents a single point. And for something so simple, there's a remarkable amount of flexibility and complexity to markers. You can just say, give me a new marker at a specific lat long, which is exactly what we're doing at the top here. And this will give you the default red push pin, the little black dot in that you're probably familiar with. However, you can also define your own icons. It's obviously a very popular thing to do. There are two ways to do that. You can create a new gicon object from scratch and populate all the fields, or you can clone an existing icon, which is what we're doing in this line here. We're cloning the default icon, and then manipulate various properties. The full list of properties for the gicon object is quite long. It's not mandatory to complete all of them, but a lot of them are recommended. They include properties, obviously, for the image itself, but also for its shadow. They include you can specify where the point within the image that is tied to the lat long for that mark on the map. For example, if you think of the red push pin, you clearly want that to be pinned at the bottom of the pin. But if you were to come up with a marker that consisted of a target, you would want it pinned in the middle. Similarly, you can also specify alternative GIF images to use for printing. We find that some browsers composite GIF images better than PNG images. You can specify essentially where those info window bubbles you saw on the real estate website, where they attach to your markers. There's a lot of things you can do with custom markers. And then essentially what you do here is to actually use the custom marker, you when you create your gmarker object, which is the class relating to marker overlays, you always have to pass in a point, which is our glat long object for that marker. But then there are a set of options on the end. Now, the Maps API, a lot of the classes in the Maps API have options, documented sets of options, and in almost all cases they are passed in as these things called object literals, which if you're coming to JavaScript from another language, it may seem a little strange. An object literal is essentially a set of attribute value pairs, and you're literally creating an anonymous object inline when you do this, but kind of inconsequential for our purposes. All you need to know is that you'll see a list of options and you just say name colon value comma name colon value, all in curly braces. So, a very common problem that comes up on many Maps API sites is how do you deal with very large volumes of data? The way that overlays, and we haven't talked about some of the others, but we will shortly, but the way that polygons, polylines, markers, ground overlays, which are essentially where you add an image over the top of the map, all of this work is done client-side. When you add a marker in your Maps API application, no information gets sent to Google that says you've added a marker, or why you've added a marker, or where. It's all done client-side. Your browser literally places all these different things as objects on your map. And there comes a point when the number of markers that you're displaying begins to become a problem for your browser. It depends on the browser you choose to use as to when that point arrives, but even with some of the faster browsers, when you get up into hundreds and hundreds of markers, things start to slow down. So we provide this Marker Manager class, which essentially allows you to manage large amounts of markers by setting some markers to only appear at certain higher zoom levels than others in order to constrain the number of markers that are visible in your current viewport at any one time. And also, as it says, it buffers markers which are out of viewport. In other words, it doesn't add to the map anything you cannot actually see at that time. There are many other solutions to this problem. It's a hot topic of discussion. Clustering is another popular approach, which is where you attempt to merge markers that are in close proximity with each other together. There are various solutions out there, open source APIs to do this. There's even a company that actually provides that as a service for larger businesses. Polylines and polygons. So markers represent a point, polylines represent a path, a line on the map, and polygons represent an area, a shape. There are two different types of polyline, if you like, or at least maybe I should say there are two different ways of creating a polyline. The simplest way and the most logical way is just to provide an array of lat longs, and these are the vertices of your line. There is another format called encoded polylines, which is essentially where you we have an encoding algorithm that can take a long list of vertices and compact them into a Base64 style encoded string. You can also add level information to that polyline, which essentially says only draw certain vertices above a certain zoom level. So you can apply simplification to your polyline because polylines can get very long and very complex, particularly if they're something like a state boundary. And you may not want to draw every vertices when you're zoomed right out and the polyline actually only takes up sort of 100 pixels on your map. Polygons, which are G-polygon objects, are very, very similar to polylines, except they're filled. The only thing to bear in mind is that they don't close automatically. You have to, if you want a closed polygon, your last vertices must be the same as your first vertices. Okay, let's see if we can give you some examples of that. Okay. So here's a simple polyline example. Create a G polyline object. give it two lat longs in an array, and then there are two additional arguments. That's the color in RGB hex notation, and a weight, which is a width in pixels. And here you can see the resulting simple polyline. It's just a straight line because it's only got two vertices. You'll see that we add it using map.addOverlay. This is the method you use to add any type of overlay, be it a marker, polyline, polygon, ground overlay, all added with map.addOverlay. And we could add as many additional vertices to that polyline as we like. One thing, though, is that by default, polylines will be drawn, so the connections between vertices will be drawn as straight lines on the map, so-called rum lines. As I mentioned earlier, you may want a geodesic, and you can choose to have a geodesic. It's one of these options I mentioned. If you have a look here, we're actually creating the options separately in this case, and then passing it in here. Oh, it's gone a bit skew-if. There we go. And that will draw you the curve line. Even though this point only has two vertices, it's still, you get the curve line that you need. That actually is the shortest route between those two points on the Earth. I mentioned briefly encoded polylines. This is what an encoded polyline looks like. And then the levels is a separate string. I say the algorithm is available online. You can also you can construct a polyline from an encoded string. Let's see if we zoom out. You can see that that long string represents this whole polyline. Although that string may have seemed fairly long, it's actually a pretty compact notation for complex polylines. Okay. Another type of overlay, two other types of overlays. Ground overlays essentially involve giving the maps API an image and giving it a set of boundaries at top left and bottom right-hand corner on the Earth, and it will place that image at that location. There's more to it than meets the eye. It doesn't just take your image and slap it on the map. It will actually project the image for you. So I mentioned earlier that that as part of the Mercator projection, your latitude scale increases as you move towards the poles, which means that if you take a image and you want to place it on a map, and you want it to be, it's spanning a fairly large range of latitudes, you actually need to stretch it towards the top to keep it consistent. And the G-ground overlay will do that for you. Alternatively, custom tile layers is where you actually say, I have my own tile set. I don't want to use your tile set, or I want to overlay my tiles on top of your tiles, if, for example, they are semi-transparent or they only cover a certain part of the Earth. We've seen some really interesting uses of custom tile overlays. The most common usage is, for example, to do a campus map or something like that, or if a city has their own map data for their own region, but they don't want they want people to be able to pan around the edges, and there to be our map data around the edges where they don't have data. But we've seen people use this for things like car brochures, online car brochures, where they'll create a very, very high resolution image of the car, and then they'll create a set of custom tiles out of that image, literally cut it up into images and create them at various different zoom levels, and then use the Maps API essentially just as their user interface, as an image browser, if you like, for their product. We've also seen people build World of Warcraft maps using custom tile overlays. There's all manner of interesting things you can do with it. Okay, before we go on to geoengineering and drone directions, there's just one thing I wanted to mention that isn't in the slide, which is events. Clearly, you need you want to be able to respond to user interactivity with your map, and the way that the Maps API supports this is through the GEvent object, which allows you to add a listener for various different event types to the different objects that you place on your map and to the map itself. The Maps API reference contains a list of all the events that each class accepts. And the way that events work is that you call gevent.addListener, you give it a reference to the object that you want to register the listener against, you specify the name of the event as a string, in this case just a single click, and then you pass in a function reference. So in this case, we're creating an anonymous function inline. Very simple example, if I click on the map, get an alert. What's not obvious from this example is that the click event passes in a number of parameters to that function, including the lat long where you clicked, any overlays that were under that lat long as well. So you can respond in all sorts of interesting ways. And different classes take different generate different events, including, for example, the marker. A marker object also has its own range of click events. The markers can also be made draggable, so users can pick them up and move them around. And you can listen for events when they start dragging and when they're dragging and when they end dragging and so forth. Similarly, you can register events for the map object when overlays are added, when it's zoomed, when it's panned, when the map type changes. All the different operations someone might do using a control, you can register event listeners for and respond to them. Okay. So we're going to talk about two of the services that we provide in conjunction with the Maps API to make Maps API development easier. The most commonly used one is geocoding, and this there are, I would say, probably 60 or 70% of all Maps API applications use geocoding in some form. The job of the geocoder, which is the service we provide, is to accept addresses and give you back lat longs. Or the other way around, take it lat longs and tell you what the address is for that location. And that latter operation is known as reverse geocoding. This is a forward geocoding example. Essentially, you create a new gclient geocoder object, which is the class that provides the connection to our geocoding service. And then there are two different methods you can use to geocode. This is the simplest one, get lat long. You literally provide an address, and that can be very specific, right down to a street address, or it can be quite broad, just a country or a state. We give you back it's a similar model to what I mentioned with events, which is that you also provide us with a callback function. Again, we're using an anonymous inline function here. We will execute that function once the geocode response comes back. The reason we do it this way, the reason we use this callback model is whenever we want to do anything in the Maps API which is going to rely on a backend service that's hosted by Google, we do it asynchronously. We don't want your application to hang waiting for the geocoder to respond. So it's important to remember that when you define this function, this function will be executed once the geocoder has responded, and it will be passed in this case, a lat long object, which is the lat long that matches the address that you gave. But this won't happen until the geocoder completes. And this request here, this line in your code, if you like, it will not wait. In other words, everything after it will continue to execute while we're waiting for this to happen. This catches a lot of people out in a number of ways. A common problem we have is someone develops an application where you're searching over their database of properties or cars or stores or whatever. You type in your location. That location query gets sent to their server. They send you back a list of the addresses of the 10 nearest stores, for example. And then in order to plot them on the map, you geocode those 10 locations. You basically do that by having an array. You put that array in a for loop. That for loop iterates over this geocode or get lat long. What actually happens if you do that is all 10 of those requests get sent simultaneously, or at least approximately simultaneously, certainly in parallel. They don't happen in series. And that can be a problem because there are limits on the number of requests you can make per second. So some of those requests are likely to fail because essentially you're throwing a chunk of geocoding requests at us at the same time. So you need to be careful with these asynchronous functions like this, that you manage the way that they, the timing, if you like, if you're doing a lot of them. The way around that, incidentally, if you want to be absolutely sure that that isn't going to happen, is to just make one request for the first in that list of addresses, and then in your function callback, trigger the second address, and essentially put them in series like that. Okay, so the get lat long object, the get lat long method, sorry, is the simplest. It just returns a lat long. Generally speaking, I wouldn't recommend you use it for anything other than quick testing. Get locations is the alternative, and it's a far superior approach. Get locations not only it returns an object literal, essentially a JSON object literal, that contains everything that the geocoder has to say, which can mean more than one result. If you give a vague result, such as, say, Liverpool Street, UK, you'll get back 10 results rather than just the one. It will give you back structured information, so it will say, instead of just giving you back an address, it will say, this is the street number, this is the street name, this is the zip code, this is the et cetera, et cetera. It will also give you back a recommended viewport for each of those. It will tell you essentially what, where we recommend you center and size your map to fit that whole feature in. And crucially, it will return a status code for the whole request. There's only one status code, no matter how many results you get back. And that status code tells you, did your geocoding request succeed? If it did not succeed, why did it fail? And that allows you to provide more meaningful feedback to your users. With get lat long, all you get back if it fails is null. And a lot of people don't think to catch that, and then they just get errors coming out of their application if you put in a meaningless address or address that we can't parse. So strongly recommend you use get locations. The actual full structure of that, that response is all documented in the reference. It's a bit too long, really, to put on a slide. Reverse geocoding is essentially going the other way. You give us a lat long, we give you back an address. Similar model. Again, this example uses get locations. The reverse geocoding will practically always give you more than one result. And what it will do is it will give you the results. The results you'll get back will be all the features that contain that point in order of specificity. So the first result, which is normally the one you want, will be, if there is one, a street address. And then the next result may be the street, and then the next result may be the city, and then the zip code, and you'll get a separate result for each of those things. But the result at the top, the first one, will itself also contain all those containing features. So normally you can just use the first one. One thing I should mention, because it catches a lot of people out, always remember that the geocoder's principal purpose is to map addresses to lat longs and back, postal addresses. So it's best to try and clean up your addresses before you geocode to conform to that model. So throw away floor numbers, throw away unit numbers, throw away business names, throw away resident names. These things will just distract the geocoder and potentially undermine the quality of your results. Try and keep it to just street addresses. Okay, we also have a HTTP geocoding service, which allows you to make geocode requests over a REST-based XML type API. This is particularly useful if you have a very large number of addresses that you need to geocode, but they're fixed. So for example, if you're a real estate site, you have 10,000 properties on your portfolio. Those are the only addresses that your application will ever be interested in looking at. So why not just geocode them all once, and then your users won't have to geocode them every time they look at them. And you can do that using the HTTP geocoding service. We strongly discourage people from using the HTTP geocoding service to geocode on behalf of users' requests in real time. In other words, it might be tempting to say, well, you know, I could use GClient Geocoder here, but if I do that, I don't know what they're doing because it goes straight to Google. So why don't I just send that address request that they're typing in their browser at that moment to Google, sorry, to me, I can log it, I can do interesting things with it, then I can make a HTTP geocoding request to Google, capture the response, cache it, send it back to the customer. Might sound like a good idea, actually a very bad one, because it funnels all of the geocoding requests that your entire user base are making through a single IP address, your IP address. That will add a single point of failure to your application. It will undermine the performance benefits we have from having distributed data centers. Instead of going to the nearest data center, they'll go to your site, and then they'll go to your nearest data center, and so you're doubling your latency. It will expose you, if your application suddenly has a huge spike in popularity, let's say it's featured on the news or on a blog, you stand a risk of running into, you know, we do have some usage limits and some abuse systems in place, and if one specific IP starts deluging us, you know, that IP will be restricted in its access to the service. So really strongly recommend you don't use the HTTP geocoding service as a proxy for client-side activity. Just use it for just use it for offline batch geocoding, which is really its intended purpose. Okay, directions. How are we doing? Oh, almost done. Okay. Directions, we have a service for generating driving directions, for doing routing, essentially. You give us a from address, you give us a to address. We will give you back a set of textual directions that map out that route, localized accordingly. So the localization will determine not just the language that we say, you know, whether it's right or droit, but also whether we use miles or kilometers and those kind of things. And we'll also give you back a polyline that represents the route from the map. And if you give us a map and a panel, just another div, we will do all the work for you. We will populate that div with the textual directions, with the nice markers at the top and bottom, and the little links that pop up zoom-ins. We will resize the map to fit the whole route. We'll draw the polyline on the route. We'll put the markers at either end. All that with a single request. So I can demonstrate that here. I imagine, there we are. So here we go. Got a map, we have a panel for the direction output. We create a new GDirections object, pass both those things in. We register event listeners, which essentially tell us when the directions have returned. Again, it's an asynchronous service. And then we make a call to get directions from to with this locale, so from San Francisco to Mountain View. And this is what happens. All of this was rendered for you by the GDirections object. You had to obviously create the map, but once you've done that, everything else has been done for you. And if I click on one of these little links, you'll get nice little zoom-in bubbles as well. It is possible, if you don't want this to happen, to use the GDirections object without it manipulating your map and without it filling in these properties, and instead actually query a data structure, which is the number of the different routes, if you've had multiple, if you combine multiple routes into a single query, and then the individual steps, and you can query for the distances and the times for each step, and you can render the directions yourself. It's a lot of work, but if you really want tight control, you can get it. Okay, lastly, Street View. I'm sure some of you are aware of Street View. It's now possible to embed Street View panoramas into your Maps API applications. Essentially, you create a GStreetView panorama object. Again, you give it a div, which is the div we're going to populate with the Flash player that displays the Street View. And then you set a location, and optionally you set what we call a point of view, which is essentially, okay, I want a Street View at this location, but I want it to point in that direction at that pitch at a certain zoom level. Do we have any Street? Yes, we do. Okay. So here's an example. You can see we've got a GLAT long object here, which is the location, and then we create our Street View panorama. We pass in that location as an option, and we also, again, add a listener, which will be called if there's a problem, for example, if the Flash player isn't installed on this particular browser. And this is what you get. The UI is pretty much fixed. You'll get the standard panning control, standard zoom control, and you'll get these little links for moving around. You can register listeners on your Street View Panorama object for all of these events. You can register a listener for changes in yaw, pitch, zoom, and also for clicking on these arrows. That means it's fairly straightforward to synchronize your Street View with a map. You can have the two things bound together so that if you listen for the event that occurs when you click on one of these arrows and that panorama moves, you can check the location of the new panorama, update a marker on the map. Similarly, you can make the marker draggable. If you drag the marker, the panorama will update and sync. Okay, I mentioned this point of view, which is what we're talking about here. The default point of view is a yaw of zero, so pointing due north, pitch of plus five, so slightly above the horizon, a zoom level of zero, which is fully zoomed out. Okay, so a few links here. We have very comprehensive documentation for the Maps API, lots of examples. The playground is excellent also for seeing with code and playing with code. I'm going to just bring up the reference because it's good to have a look at it. This is just a permanent bookmark for me, but this isn't my laptop. So. Okay, so this is what it looks like. Essentially, it just breaks down all the different types of classes. And then lists all the methods for each class, what they, what type they return, and then At the bottom of each class is a list here of all the different events that they can generate that you can listen for, and also what type of data is passed into the anonymous function or the callback function that you register for that event. I strongly encourage you to check the documentation, have a look at the developer guide, lots of examples as well, and the playground, and enjoy. Thank you very much. I've kind of run over a little bit because we started a bit late. So if you have any questions, feel free to just come up and grab me.